So in the spirit of today, our reading this morning is from 2 Corinthians chapter 4. So we do not lose heart. Even though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all measure, because we look not at what can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. So 100 years ago is hard to imagine. And yet, in the East End congregation, we have two members, one who turned 100 in February and one who in July will be 103. They were born in 1918 and 1915. And I checked with Nancy Holland, when was Dick Hawkins' mother born? 1915. And the other folks have relatives living that are 100 or over at this point. It's rare, and 100 years ago is eons in some ways, but it's really not that distant. So travel back with me. In 1918, life was hard. In one article I read, it noted, in short, everything was worse, except the commute. People around then had a life expectancy of about 50 years, and that had been an improvement over the very recent past. In contrast, today it's about 80 years. Infant mortality was high. It was close to 10%. But that was also about to change. High school graduation rates were less than 20%. Less than 20%. But in just 20 years, high school graduation rates would be up to 50%. It was a time of change in 1918. For most men, and when I say men here, picture men and what I would now still call boys. 85% of boys and men over 14 were working, many of them, particularly in manufacturing or farming, well over 55 or 60 hours a week. Women did predominantly work in the home at this time, but there were women working outside of the home. And one quote I found said, school boards preferred female teachers, not only because they were more loving, but because they would do what male principals told them to do while accepting less than a man's wage. People had to spend close to a third of their income on food, and for some reason, this one fact has just grabbed me, if you wanted to bring your lunch, there was no plastic wrap. Just think about that. Homes, more people rented their homes than actually bought them homes, but by huge numbers, more people were renters. And electricity and telephone service were in about 30% of the homes by this point. About 20% of the homes had a stove. Modern refrigerators, not ice boxes, but a modern refrigerator was absolutely in its infancy. And cars were not that rare. People would have seen cars in most communities, but there were about 7 million registered cars and 100 million people. That ratio has changed dramatically. And by 1918, the Unitarian faith would have been around and named as the Unitarian faith for about 100 years at the time. And its deepest roots of the Unitarian faith were in New England. And across the town square in New England, many, many Unitarian churches would have been in New England towns. And across the town square, you'd find its congregational cousin. Nowadays, you'd think of it as United Church of Christ, but that was from an earlier split. So Unitarians were very common in New England. But by 1918, they had also moved to most cities in the United States and towns across the Midwest. Closest to here, the first Unitarian Church in Baltimore was founded in 1818. All Souls Unitarian in D.C. was founded in 1821, and First Wilmington was founded in 1866. And as you, if you were to go west in the country, it would get less and less traditional. So a lot of what we're playing around with today is a fairly traditional Unitarian service. The male ministers may have worn a Geneva robe, sort of more of an academic robe that would give you an idea how closely the Unitarians were tied through Harvard and different places to that academic world. But as you went west, the tradition would have been less and less traditionally Christian. They tended, the further they got from Boston, to break more traditions, may have less chance that you'd see a robed minister at the time. But gearing up for the service today, we actually, Margot found an 1877 hymnal that this congregation owned, who would have known, and we looked through some of the 1914 hymn books because they actually had the actual words that were used in some of the services. Similar to what we have today, we have both words and hymns in the service. And I also had checked in with Reverend Mark Harris, who's the Unitarian Universalist minister in Watertown, Massachusetts, and sort of a guru on this. And his thoughts are woven in with mine at a point that I can't quite find who's or who's at this point. So in 100 years ago, the worship, the music, and the congregational life would have been unmistakably Christian. Service would have been biblically grounded. There would have been organs played. We've gotten a keyboard in today. We could have played around with that. They definitely would have read scripture, and the Psalms were a huge part of Unitarian worship. If you look at 200 pages of some of the writings, 150 of it is different psalms that were used. So the Hebrew scripture and those songs and poetry were very prevalent in the Christian services of the time, Unitarian and others. So what made us different? A lot of the Unitarianness would have come across in the words. For example, I looked at a communion service at the time, and communion, communion still done, or traditional bread and wine communion in some churches in New England today, but it was still used fairly regularly around 1918 from what we can find out. Not that frequently, but it was also not very frequent in Methodist and other churches. Communion has gotten much more frequent in Protestant churches of late. It was just not that common. It was fallen off the radar screen. People would do it every 6 weeks or 8 weeks. It's not that they didn't do it, but it was not as common. But here are some words from the Unitarians. Communion service. We are assembled here to meditate together on the life and death of Jesus Christ, that we may consecrate ourselves more earnestly to the service of God and to one another. In his acts of love and sympathy for the suffering, his compassion and help for the weak and sinful, he has left us an example that we should follow in his steps. In communion with him and with all who have been faithful servants of God, counting not their lives unto themselves, we now offer our prayers to the Father in heaven. So the Unitarians at the time would have definitely been about God. They would have referred to Father on high and thee, and the King James Bible would have been more commonly used. But Jesus here is revered, but not referenced as the Son of God. And he is grouped with others who have been faithful. So the communion was likely not frequent, and it was a place to touch base with Jesus as somebody to follow, but not the Son of God. And similarly, the Bible readings were always subject to scrutiny and analysis and healthy critique. And that sense of Jesus as great prophet and the Bible as inspirational but worthy of analysis, those were two aspects of long-held Unitarian beliefs. That would go back the full century. But if I looked through some of the period-based sermons, and a lot of them did address current events. The Unitarians were definitely of the world and not trying to separate folks. There would also be sermons on forgiveness and sermons on all sorts of traditional topics, but there would be sermons on the public schools, immigrations, issues of science. by 1918, the vast majority of Unitarians, both lay and ordained, had supported the United States entry into World War I in 1917. It was a few months after that that the Association, the American Unitarian Association, after debate, decided it needed to take a position on the war. And what's fascinating to me is the leader of the Unitarians at the time, what we call the moderator for the annual conference, was former President Taft. Former President Taft was a Unitarian. He had been, before Woodrow Wilson, he had been the President of the United States. He would go on to become a Supreme Court Justice. And in the middle, he's leading the Unitarians. They have a debate, and one minister, John Haynes Holmes, gave the pacifist position. And pacifism was not very common anywhere in the United States at this time. It was a place of what are you going to do to confront fascism? And ultimately, they voted 236-9 in support of World War I. And it was the statement that said this: war must be carried to a successful issue to stamp out militarism in the world, that we, the Unitarian body, approve the measures of President Wilson and Congress to carry on this war. And that in and of itself is not that surprising. That was very common just across the United States, that the good Christian values would take you to fight out tyranny, and sometimes war was needed. So that was not that unusual. But what did become unusual is we are based on something called local polity. Each congregation makes its own decisions, and yet the word came from on high, from Boston again. And the Reverend Samuel Elliott, who for about 30 years led the denomination as the lead minister, so to speak, he said ministers who hadn't supported the war should be dismissed. And many were. There weren't that many, and they broke off to form other groups. But the thought was, if you were of strong moral fiber, that was directly tied to patriotism. And that's why some of the traditional Protestant churches existed. Another point, think about 1918. Many in this room could not have voted. And after many false starts, the women's vote was getting close. After decades of false starts, Woodrow Wilson had supported the right for women to vote, yet Taft had doubts. He had expressed times, one of his questions would women be too emotional? I'm thinking we just might be a little emotional on that issue. That's not a bad thing. So while many of the women who had fought for suffrage for decades and decades were Unitarians, not the only ones, but there were Unitarians and Quakers and people who had been at Seneca Falls were Unitarians. At the end, the men had to support some of these votes. I'm still searching, but from what I can tell from one article, the American Unitarian Association around just about that time barely voted to support women's suffrage. As I mentioned earlier, very few ministers at the time were female, and the culture in the United States around that time was establishing roles for men and women in different distinct places, as we had a different type of a capitalist country that was just emerging out of the places where people didn't have a lot of appliances and different pieces. So I offer all this, but I also wanted to think about what would 1918 have felt like if you were African American? We sometimes tell these stories just through our own lens of what we might have known at the time. And for African Americans, this was a point where the Great Migration was really just getting started from the rural South. Reconstruction had long since passed. The opportunities were in these areas of rapid growth in the industrial areas, and there was just a huge flood of folks coming to the North. And during World War I, African Americans did fight in the war. It was predominantly segregated service, and after the service, I preached the sermon down in Easton. One of the folks who grew up in Easton, she came up to me. She said she remembered her father telling the story of Armistice. And they came down and were walking down the street. They were so excited, ripping shutters off of the homes. And her father would often tell of this parade. So I asked this congregant, and I said, do you think the African Americans from the community, in Talbot County, would have a lot of African Americans, would have been a part of a parade like that? She said, absolutely not. That was not the place that she grew up with in Easton. On Unitarian worship, Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, in an article, noted, in UU worship and liturgy, as in our scholarship, African Americans did not exist. There was nothing by or about African Americans in the UU hymnody being the songs we sing. In 1937, so jumping forward a bit, there was nothing in the hymnal at all, with the exception of Battle Hymn of the Republic. It was not until our 1993 hymnal, which is the one we use today, did African American culture make a significant appearance. And there were a few African Americans who had found the Unitarian tradition, and it was a fit for them. There was one black minister who was ordained in 1912, Ethered Brown, and he led a church in Jamaica in 1918, and eventually a church in Harlem. But he was time and again undercut by the powers that be when it came to money and finances. There were some that partnered and some that didn't. So that's some stories, just taking you back to 1918. So how did we end up here today? How did we end up with this faith tradition that is so different? 100 years, not that long. So the changes have happened year by year, service by service, annual conference to annual conference. Every time in our lives that we make choices about hymns or sermon topics or Sunday school lessons, we are shaping a faith. We're not the only ones doing that. Other traditions do that as well. And it was in particularly the West. Remember I mentioned the West was less traditional. And over time, they started focusing more on freedom, fellowship, and character rather than God, Christ, and the Christian tradition. So in the West, as they started getting little less traditional, you started having space for something called the humanist movement. And that, right around 1918, was getting really big. And it wasn't so much a rejection of God. It was a sense that God was not as relevant to solving human problems. Curtis Reist, one of the founders, said, it holds that this is a man's world and that it depends on man to determine what the world shall look like. I can't emphasize enough how much 100 years ago, as that humanist mindset of it's up to us to deal with the big problems, shaped everything from our hymns to our Sunday school to our nature of worship to what we no longer sing, to some of the things that have changed to meet what our challenges are today. I think 1918, in some ways, is a cusp in a bit like what we're like in 2018. Lots of stuff was changing all around folks, and they held on to their worship traditions, but they started making other changes as Unitarians deeper down in there. So what about that ancestry guides us today? Where are the openings to shape what our faith is going to become? Think about that question, because I don't think it's about getting faith right or getting worship right, but just to look at the context of where we are in 2018, what makes a faith work for you? What parts have you claimed? What parts are you ready to jettison? What parts would you like to readopt and sing more often? What is the language? I had a friend, and I also think about the evolution over the last 20 to 30 years, and I had a friend who recently shared a story about her 90-year-old father. And he had been a really active Unitarian Universalist in one of the suburban DC congregations in the 1960s and 70s. This guy, from what I can tell, I've read a couple of his sermons. He was a lay leader. He was teaching adult education. He was involved in every level. And then as things happened, he moved away around 1980, moved far away, just lost touch with the Unitarian Church. Then in 2017, he had a reason to be back at a Unitarian Universalist service, and he was appalled by the lighting of the chalice. Why are we bothering to light candles, he asked. Isn't that what we spent years rejecting? And what's this about ministers wearing stoles and robes? He happened to be at a memorial service. And so we wear stoles. Once in a while we robe. Not very often. So 100 years ago, those Unitarians, they could not have pictured earth-based traditions or hearing about something called a UU Buddhist. It just would have sounded impossible. Same-sex marriage and guidelines for children on Facebook, that just wasn't the focus yet. Nor was the chalice, or joys and sorrows, or having a female minister. What are we going to carry forward? What's the same? What's the unseen part that keeps coming forward? What do we still share with those ancestors? Just a few things. We do carry forward regular worship as a time to engage heart and mind. We need to make time really regularly to address the challenges of life. And we have rituals of song and word. And as Unitarians, we're focused on big questions. We're not the only ones doing that, but we ask questions on voting and immigration because while some things are settled in law, there's not settled in practice or sharing power. We ask those hard questions. We carry forward, I think, the most, some impetus to connect, to keep things moving, to keep things getting better, to look for inspiration. So the roots are similar. The stuff that's below the surface is very much the same, and it will change. We'll experiment, and some are going to be thrilled with new things. Some are going to hate every time we change a pattern, even anything we change today, I'm sure. But I do think if we're finding those ways to connect, it matters. And the Universalists were also going through their struggles. It's a whole separate sermon. But I think the reason the sermon excites me, the reason I get excited about looking back 100 years ago, is it's just a reminder that this congregation, when it meets on Sundays, is connected way back on the shoulders of ancestors, on the shoulders of folks that didn't expect us to keep it the same. And we're now going to be those shoulders for the next groups coming forward. What can you imagine next? Don't even reach 100 or 50 years. Reach out 5 or 10 years. What parts of this Unitarian Universalist faith hold you? What have you claimed? Why is it important to you? What do you hope will change? Because it is in our hands. It is in our hands to move the faith forward, shaping it one service at a time. So we close in gratitude for our roots and the promises of wings as together we figure it out. May it be so.